From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we have a firsthand account of what it's like to be a COVID-19 survivor in Milwaukee. Bubbler Talk looks at how the pandemic is affecting students with special needs. We talk about how the coronavirus has reawakened some long-standing debates on the nature of our government.
Democracy isn't just about voting. It's not just about aggregating preferences. It's about discussion with one another to generate a conception of a common good.
Plus, a project by local arts organizations is putting masks and face shields in the hands of frontline workers.
We've got, I believe, about 15 people working from their homes to build masks, and we do a weekly delivery of about 800 masks a week to Children's Hospital, about 120 masks a week to Freighter.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the U.S. has over a million total cases of COVID-19. In Wisconsin, the number of cases is over 8,500. Numbers like these can be a little hard to grasp until coronavirus affects you or someone you know. For us here at WUWM, our former staff member Danielle Nelson was that someone. Danielle is an otherwise healthy 37-year-old woman with no pre-existing conditions who was seemingly at low risk for contracting coronavirus. Then she had chest pains. Initially, she dismissed it. Then it escalated, and she was hospitalized with COVID-19. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share her story in the hope that others can connect with it and learn from her experience. Danielle begins by explaining when she initially started to feel unwell.
So I started having chest pain around probably March 12th or 13th. And I didn't really think too much of it because these are crazy times we're living in. And I thought it was just anxiety. And so I kind of shrugged it off. But then on March 16th, I started feeling a little off in the morning. And then by the evening, I had a kind of a full-on fever. And so I pretty much did not leave my bed for the next several days until the afternoon of March 19th, when I ended up going to the ER to get tested. It was a really brief visit. They gave me a prescription for albuterol to help with breathing, which at the time I didn't need. So I went home, went immediately back to bed, and then, you know, really kind of took a turn for the worse. And so it got to the point where, you know, it was really hard to walk. I was resisting the urge to crawl, you know, to get around the house. So in the later afternoon of March 24th, I ended up going back to the ER and then was there until the 29th and then was back home and have been recovering from home since March 29th.
So before you went to the ER that first time to get tested, were you on the phone with a doctor and the recommendation was to go and get tested? Was it a difficult thing to get testing? Because that is kind of an inconsistent thing right now throughout the country is testing availability.
Yeah, I think maybe for the area, it was maybe ahead of the curve. So, you know, there was no wait in the emergency room. I was in and out in 15 minutes. And I didn't call anyone ahead of time. I just had a feeling. And my fever was kind of all over the place while I was in bed from, you know, it would be 99 and then it spiked at 104. So I knew that I just really was not well and I shouldn't have a fever for that many days in a row. So I just went to the ER.
Right. And you are, you know, a young, healthy person, no pre-existing conditions, no history of smoking, nothing like that. It was unexpected, right?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, when I look at the list of, you know, folks or conditions that might put me more at risk, I don't meet any of them. And so it was another reason I kind of looked past the chest pain initially, just because I thought, you know, I shouldn't really be at risk. You know, so maybe I could worry a little bit less, but that was obviously my mistake.
Well, and there's a lot of information being bombarded at us. So by the time you're admitted into the hospital, and this was before any tests came back positive or negative, correct?
Right.
So what was your experience like to be a COVID patient inside the hospital?
Being in the hospital with COVID was really scary and really isolating because, as you probably know, no one's allowed into the hospital. And so I was there by myself. And, you know, I've been messaging with someone on Facebook who is in the hospital now with COVID. And
more of Lake Effect Weekend now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM education reporter Emily Files. I put a call out to families asking about their new normal during this time of school shutdowns. Shorewood resident John Burgess sent me this.
Our new normal is barely coping. I teach a large enrollment undergraduate biology course at UWM. We're currently trying desperately to do that online, and we're just managing.
And John says those are just the challenges at work.
At home, I'm trying to help my son Theo cope with online learning from high school.
John's son Theo is 16 years old and a special needs student at Shorewood High School. He's nonverbal and has developmental delays. At school, Theo gets one-on-one help in classes, along with speech and occupational therapy, and life skills training. But the coronavirus school closure took away Theo's routine and supports. Here's Theo's mom, Erica Young.
First thing in the morning when I'm making breakfast, he comes and asks me about school multiple times. Are you thinking maybe, hopefully, we could go to school today? Yeah, so that's a bit tough that we have to explain that.
Theo's parents are trying to help him with online schooling while balancing their full-time jobs. Like John, Erica is a professor at UWM.
Our day is a little crazy. We usually just do a tag team thing from about 8:30 till 5:30, where one of us is working upstairs and one of us is working with Theo.
Mary Demerit is one of Theo's teachers at Shorewood High School. Each day at 10 a.m., she holds an online Zoom lesson with four of her special education students. I listened in on a recent class where the topic was DNA.
Theo, do you have similar traits to people in your family?
Blue eyes.
Awesome. You've got blue eyes. And who did you get those blue eyes from, Theo?
Who do you think? From Dad?
From Dad.
Demerit says the switch to virtual learning has been hard for her students, and one of them doesn't participate in the Zoom classes at all because they're too overwhelming.
The virtual side has been a little difficult for students who need a lot more one-on-one support throughout their school day. So we're just kind of doing the best we can with these virtual meetings.
John and Erica say they've had to cut back on work from one of Theo's classes, which involved a lot of reading and research. Erica says they don't have the training to modify the readings for Theo's attention span. Meanwhile, other families with special needs children have been yearning for more outreach from their schools.
It's definitely been difficult.
Deanna Becerra, who's 22, has taken on the role of de facto teacher for her younger brother, Diego. He's a junior at Milwaukee's Bayview High School. Diego has Down syndrome and normally receives individualized education. But Deanna says she's gotten barely any help navigating the paper packets and online tools MPS has on its website.
I'm trying to work with him alongside my sister with doing math problems, reading problems, but it's just frustrating again because I don't know his exact level. So I don't know if it's too easy, if it's too hard, if he doesn't want to show me because I'm his sister. I mean, he's used to his teachers and I'm sure he works a lot better at school than he would at home.
Some families have questioned why MPS has taken longer to implement a district-wide standard for remote learning. Special education teachers weren't told to reach out to families until late April. Disability advocacy groups have concerns about the disparities in special education during the pandemic. Monica Murphy is managing attorney with Disability Rights Wisconsin.
The school districts are doing or not doing are all over the map. Many of the bigger districts aren't really doing anything as far as special ed is concerned. So that's problematic. Kids aren't getting anything and they're obviously falling further and further behind in the districts where they started off behind to begin with.
On the other hand, Murphy says some districts are going overboard and overwhelming families. Murphy says schools should try to tailor what's offered to the individual needs of each student and their family, similar to what they would do during a normal school year.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sun Badger Solar. During this pandemic, WUWM is answering your questions about the coronavirus and its impact on the Milwaukee area. Submit yours at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend. Coming up, we'll learn how the coronavirus pandemic has reawakened some long-standing debates on the nature of our government. That's next on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. The coronavirus has invigorated debates around civil rights and democracy throughout America. Here in Wisconsin, a coalition of conservative activists are petitioning the state Supreme Court for a second time to overturn safer at home directives. The activists say Governor Evers' limits on gatherings infringe on their rights to religion and assembly. To check in on how these debates square with historical concepts of freedom in America, Lake Effect's Julian Haida called up Jennifer Fenton, a visiting assistant professor in political theory at Marquette University.
Jennifer Fenton, thank you for joining us on Lake Effect.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
The first question I wanted to ask you has to do with people who are dissenting to the stay-at-home orders, the safer-at-home orders. There are a lot of protests here in Wisconsin, and they're comparing safer-at-home orders often to tyranny. Now, when I think of tyranny, I think of the Revolutionary War. I think of an oppressive king from across the ocean. When, over the course of American political life, did tyranny come to mean what it is today, which is an expression of government overreach?
How are the people who are using this language to defy stay-at-home orders, you know, sort of what ideological framework are they thinking of? And I think it's important to sort of think about different conceptions of freedom in the history of how Americans have thought about democracy, how democratic theorists have thought about democracy. And so sort of the Enlightenment era of freedom is this conception of like freedom from domination from a monarch, right? And so we introduced checks and balances. But then during the Industrial Revolution, late 19th, early 20th century, a lot of political theorists started thinking about freedom in a more expansive way because they were trying to think about freedom and equality in the context of industrial capitalism. And so industrialism brought this really new way of humans living and working with one another. So you have the rise of the modern city, factories, mass migration to urban landscapes. And so a lot of political theorists early 20th century started thinking about freedom as something that is not just freedom from domination of the state, but the freedom to live a meaningful life. This sort of second wave conception of freedom has focused a lot around community. And the sort of communitarian movement, one of the central claims has been that, you know, love and friendship cannot survive their parties constantly insisting on their rights. And I borrow this from a virtue ethics theorist, like that community is more than just about individuals exercising their rights and their freedom, right? And so I think we have this divide in our country between these sort of two conceptions of freedom.
It feels a lot like the labor movement. The labor movement really rose at the turn of the last century. So when you hear people, you know, using the right to work as a stance in opposition to stay-at-home orders, how does that kind of sit with you in the way that it evokes a kind of labor rights thing?
The focus of the narrative is on the government restricting people's freedom to participate in the economy. Because alternatively, the narrative could be focused on the government's responsibility to be transparent about the decision-making processes, or the government's responsibility to ensure that people have access to healthcare and access to a living wage during this time. But the narrative is shifted towards big bad government instead of, I'm a citizen and this government is accountable to me. I think that we need to be really careful about the ways that we insist on individual rights, because too many individual aggregates insisting on their individual rights can actually cooperatively or sort of collectively undermine a public good or a public interest. Some of the way that we use the language of rights is actually introducing practices that individually these people are protecting their right to freedom, but collectively it has the effect of undermining an interest for a group, such as like the ability for unionization efforts to be successful. I mean, it undermines the capacity for unions to be productive.
And I'm wondering if that fits into the kind of the same justification that's used, I deserve to work, without necessarily, for example, taking into account people who also need to work who are immunocompromised and will have even less of an opportunity to work if the people they're supposed to be working with might be harboring the coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a political theorist, you know, studying deliberative democracy theory, which is a theory of democracy that says democracy isn't just about voting. It's not just about aggregating preferences. It's about discussion with one another to generate a conception of a common good. And so one of the fundamental sort of challenges that we see when we're trying to understand the exercising of individual rights, but also the common good, is that the mere aggregation of people's preferences, the mere exercising of individual rights, does not necessarily produce a common good.
Whereas the argument can be made on both sides of the coronavirus debate that on one hand, staying home and taking economic loss is for the common good, or on the other side, reopening the economy despite the apparently inevitable return of the virus is in the common good because at least people will be employed. So both sides are appealing to a common good, but there's still a lack of kind of common language here. How has that been kind of addressed in this deliberative process?
My worry in sort of a laissez-faire capitalist conception of the common good, the thinking is that, well, every individual having the right to pursue his or her own economic interests is in the common good. But that sort of misses something important about what democracy is about. I mean, democracy is about people working together to define a public interest. It's not about people working individually to pursue their own private interests, and then like that is itself in the public good.
It seems like some people believe that, though. I mean, there's a
yes.
Whole stock belief in that.
Yes, they do. And I think the worry is that that is not how you successfully solve problems in any organization. I mean, just imagine if you're just a small organization and everyone is just furthering what they think is the interest of the organization, or maybe even some of them are furthering their own private personal interests. Right. So the fallacy in sort of the laissez-faire capitalist conception of a common good is that a bunch of individuals pursuing their own private interests will necessarily create a good society. And but to take this even further, the real worry for myself as a democratic theorist who's interested in social justice is that this will also not produce a just society. Because justice is about defining a good for everyone.
In other words, you're afraid that people will self-organize in a manner that is inherently unequal. But some people say that, well, inequality is natural.
Yes, I mean, that is sort of the narrative that we're seeing in our society. And we've seen this narrative, I mean, this narrative has been alive and well for hundreds of years.
We see all this opposition to safer at home, stay at home orders. They've spread all over the country. We've talked a little bit about some of them, and they seem to be self-organized. Now, I've also seen some people invoke the term astroturfing, which gets to how they might have been organized. What is astroturfing, and why might people suspect their involvement in these anti-quarantine protests?
So astroturfing is referring to sort of a fake grassroots movement. So rather than real grass, it's astroturf. But so it's used in online communities, especially on the Reddit platform, to refer to coordinated and centralized efforts to design online infrastructures that give the illusion of a grassroots movement. So what will frequently happen is that Facebook groups will emerge, and people will join these Facebook groups thinking that they are local community members who are organizing a group around an ideology or a value or a movement that they care about. But really, they're coordinated and centralized efforts. And there have been some allegations that this has been the source of the anti-quarantine protests that have been happening throughout the country. So just, so I will tell you, Saturday, April 18th, there was a Redditor account, Dr. Midnight, did some research where he was finding a lot of similar domains linked to the websites that organized these Facebook protests. And then the following Monday and Tuesday, the news started picking up on this.
And when it seems like a grassroots movement, news editors, journalists such as myself, feel a need to cover these things, even though they might be smaller than we perceive them to be, correct?
Yeah, they may be smaller, but I think a lot of times we focus on the size, like, oh, the movements aren't as large as, you know, they look, right? But astroturfing does something really important. It sort of plays on some of the cultural meanings that are attached to grassroots movements, and it manipulates those cultural meanings for its purpose. And what I mean by that is there's cultural meanings tied to grassroots protesting because it sort of stands as a symbol to us that, oh wow, here's a group of disenfranchised people who are bringing forward this claim to the community for their own interest. As an underrepresented and disenfranchised community, it has that cultural meaning, that cultural value. And so an organization that stands to profit from this could fabricate grassroots organizing in order to give the public perception that this is an authentic expression of the will of disenfranchised people. One of the concerns about astroturfing is that not only does it fabricate a grassroots movement, but it also gives the movement the narrative. The narrative doesn't generate organically from a group of people. It's planted. It's a way of framing the issue that's planted in the movement efforts.
That was Jennifer Fenton. She's a visiting assistant professor in political theory at Marquette University, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Her comments on astroturfing in Wisconsin are backed up by reporting in the Washington Post and Minneapolis Star Tribune. You can see links to that and more at WUWM.com. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Theaters, like other public gathering places, are closed. Local companies like Milwaukee Rep have found creative ways to pay homage to their work and keep people engaged with their company. Still, without any stage shows, their behind-the-scenes team has been left without any sets to build, props to create, or costumes to be designed. So they've found a way to put their skills to use outside of the theater. Milwaukee Rep has teamed up with First Stage and the Milwaukee Ballet to create masks and face shields for frontline workers at Children's Hospital, as well as Freidert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Jared Clarkin, the director of production at Milwaukee Rep, is organizing the effort, and he joins me from his home to talk about it. Jared, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So as the director of production for Milwaukee Rep, what do you generally do?
I spend most of my time dealing with budgeting and planning for the overall season. My direct responsibilities are essentially to everything that you see on stage. So sets, costumes, lights, sound, all of those physical elements that the actors interact with.
So right now, what are you mostly doing?
A lot of Zoom meetings, like most of the folks who are still working right now. It's coordinating and planning for future productions. As well, we're really focused on working to help out the community by building personal protective equipment for some local hospitals.
Yeah, you know, that was an idea that it's my understanding you had. Why did you think making masks would be a good fit for your team?
So I'd love to take credit for having the original idea, but really it's the folks that work in our costume shop who, as soon as we shut down our physical building, really jumped at the chance to put their skills to work and start sewing masks for both Children's Hospital and Freidert. And then after we had got that underway, Judy Burdan from the Northwestern Mutual Foundation reached out to me. She's a former employee of the Milwaukee Rep and asked if I would be interested in coordinating an effort through a couple of different arts organizations in town to build PPE for specifically Children's Hospital. And so we've teamed up with First Stage as well as the Milwaukee Ballet to kind of pool our efforts to build these masks. And we've got, I believe, about 15 people working from their homes to build masks. And we do a weekly delivery of about 800 masks a week to Children's Hospital. And the Freidert project is a little bit smaller, but we're delivering about 120 masks a week to Freidert.
Of course, you know, each of these shops, yours, what they have at First Stage, the Milwaukee Ballet, they're generally responsible for creating so many costumes each season. And right now, with nothing really happening on stage or at businesses, there's, it seems, maybe more time to do other things. But how is it going from making, you know, these costumes, which are very different, to making these masks?
Yeah, so it's actually a fairly big shift because, you know, in our costume shop, we have all of this great equipment, big, heavy industrial irons, commercial sewing machines, big cutting tables that we can work with so that, you know, we can lay out an entire dress or suit to work on. And now all of these folks have to kind of turn around and take this operation to their houses. So we've done a lot of work with redistributing sewing machines that we have from our shop to people's homes. And then we send in about two people into the costume shop each week to deal with the large pieces of fabric that we've purchased to then cut up into smaller pieces, press those, and get them out to the folks in their homes so that they can cut them into smaller pieces and then finally sew the masks together.
It's a lot like so many of us, of course, here in the radio field, we have been relegated to closets versus studios. We have these, you know, these little rigs of microphones that are, you know, fine. They do okay, but it's nothing like being in the studio. It's nothing like, I'm sure, being in the costume shop for so many of these people. But they're still putting out quite a lot of masks. So what does it take to build each of them? Because I've seen a lot of different tutorials on how to make masks, and each of them have their own kind of unique spin on them. What do these masks look like?
So we're dealing with two basic designs, one for Freidert and one for Children's Hospital. Each hospital has their own specification of what they would like you to build. So, for example, the Children's Hospital mask is kind of a standard rectangular shape with accordion folded fabric to provide a little bit more structure there. And then it is sewn on the edges. And then because elastic is in short supply right now, almost impossible to find, we actually moved to a very small bungee cord that we then sew to the masks. And we've actually, Leslie Vaglica, one of our costume shop employees, came up with this great way to stitch that elastic to the mask that allows it to be adjustable. So we can size the mask to a smaller child's face or for a larger adult.
So the recipients are both adults and children because of where you're sending them. And they're mostly fabric, right?
Correct. That is one project that we're working on is fabric masks. We do have another paper mask project that we're working on through the Medical College of Wisconsin. But from my conversations with the folks at Children's Hospital, these masks are going to both patients and visitors to help protect them. And it also frees up the availability of the N95 masks for the frontline medical workers. And, you know, overall just keeps everybody a little bit more safe if they're wearing a mask.
Yeah. So anecdotally, I've been walking around my neighborhood and I see a lot of folks who aren't wearing masks. Of course, you can never really tell if it's because they simply don't want to wear them or because they don't have access to them. But for people who are at home and are interested in making a mask for themselves or for others, what advice would you have for them?
It's a fairly straightforward process. And if you go online to either Freightert or Children's Hospital's website, they do have both patterns that you can print out and trace the fabric to cut out and make your masks. And they also have how-to videos that walk you through the steps of how to make your mask. Obviously, having a sewing machine is really helpful and some basic sewing knowledge. But with a little bit of practice, just about anybody could pick this up. And if you've got some extra fabric laying around your house, or, you know, you could even use old pillowcases or bed sheets, a high thread count cotton is best.
All right. Well, Jared, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
No problem. Thanks for the opportunity.
Jared Clarkin is the director of production at Milwaukee Rep, and he's leading an effort to provide masks to patients and frontline workers in Milwaukee. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.